My name is Valerie Payne, and this is the podcast Binding Unity. I started this podcast because of a personal experience that helped me to see the need for unity in our society right now. I hope that you will come along with me on my quest to find unity as we seek understanding, connection, healing, and love. Hi, this is Valerie Payne, and you're listening to another episode of Finding Unity. And today I have Bonnie Olson on. Do you want to say hi, Bonnie?
Hello. This is Bonnie Olson.
So Bonnie's here, and we are going to be talking a little bit about leadership today, because in my opinion, Bonnie is an incredible leader. So first of all, Bonnie, do you mind just telling a little bit about yourself, your background, where you were raised?
I grew up in the San Fernando Valley. Yes, right? I grew up in Studio City, and, you know, back when the San Fernando Valley was mostly orange groves in the early 50s, my father was LAPD, and he was assigned to the San Fernando Valley. He was one policeman for the whole valley.
Oh, my goodness.
And he would do a big loop around the valley every day. So, you know, back then, it was the whole area just smelled like orange groves and blossoms, and it was a lovely place to grow up. I lived right next to a studio in Studio City, CBS studio, and so, you know, I'd walk home from school and watch them filming Gunsmoke, you know. So, I mean, I thought everyone had that kind of experience, yeah. And I'd watch the Gunsmoke being filmed, and then I'd walk home. But it was a really idyllic childhood living in Studio City.
That's awesome. So tell us a little bit about your background, and just kind of maybe professionally and personally, if you want to talk about that, and how that relates to leadership, and just maybe some, or what gave you some of those leadership skills.
Well, I have been an employee many times, so I think every place I worked, I learned either negatively or positively, you know, what it was like, what I expected from leadership. I worked in the medical field many, many years. I worked in surgery. I worked at surgery centers. I worked at many, many hospitals. And so I have the experience of working with people who were very strong and unreasonable. And we were adults. You know, we were not treated as equals, and our opinions didn't matter. And I get that someone has to be the leader, but I really observe firsthand people being unkind in leadership positions. I had always had the dream of starting a hospice, and all of my medical years and all the different hospitals I worked at, it was just a dream I had. And it started when I helped my own mother pass away.
Yeah.
And we had such a beautiful experience, and she kept saying things. She had pancreatic cancer, and they gave her 6 months to live, and she only lived two. But I spent all of that time with her and helping her, and she just spewed such wisdom and kindness, and she was a remarkable woman anyway. But she would say things like, death isn't bad, this isn't hard, this is okay.
Wow.
And just gave me this most wonderful feeling that death is really a part of life, and nothing to be feared. You know, it's just another phase. And so, you know, when the time was right that I could work and not have to get any money for my work, we have nine children, Richard and I together. So, you know, I had to work to bring home a paycheck for many years. But the day that my husband Richard turned to me and said, you know, I can really support us with my work now, because he had started his own business as well. He said, I can support you, and I know this is your dream to start a hospice. And, you know, I didn't go into it for financial reasons, and that felt so good. And I had the blessing of being supported by a husband who knew this was my dream. And so, you know, I never had to worry about the money. You know, I didn't have to worry about making a house payment. I could work for free, and I did for many years before I was able to draw a paycheck. But, you know, everyone I hired for that job, I always called it an interview. I always called it an audition. When I would interview someone because I felt the calling of hospice so strong from that experience with my mother and being in the medical field for so long. You know, I worked in labor and delivery, and so I kind of worked both ends. You know, I helped thousands and thousands and thousands of babies to be born, and now this is the opposite end of the spectrum, and it's so similar. Mm-hmm. You know, bringing a child into the world and helping someone pass on to the next world, the experiences are almost identical, and they call it midwifery for the dying hospice nurses. So many of the nurses that came to work with me, I had known in, you know, labor and delivery.
Wow.
And they were wonderful, you know, just wonderful. And they brought that same sensitivity and love and care. So I would hire very carefully. And I knew that this just wasn't a job. Sometimes in the medical field, staff, nursing staff, social workers, they can become institutionalized. They become very calloused towards people's pain. And so I looked for that carefully when I hired and I said, this is an audition. We're going to do an audition for a few weeks. And so, you know, I didn't always hire perfectly. Some people came and left because it just wasn't their place. The energy wasn't there for them. But for the most part, I look back at 99% of my employees, and every single person there were highly sensitive, tremendously caring, and it was a beautiful experience to surround these people in their last days and weeks of life with people who really cared. And so I had so much respect for the people I hired. And I'm not a nurse. I was a surgical tech, so that's how I got into the medical field. I'm not a nurse, I'm not a social worker. You know, I'm not a chaplain, but I had so much respect for these people that, you know, had these skills and that would come in and do the things they did. Incredible. You know, they would sit bedside for hours and hours and hours. And the beautiful social workers who would just work so hard to unify the families, because unfortunately, and I have this in my own experience with my own family, with my own brothers and sisters, as my own father was passing, there was commotion, and it was very, very sad. And so to have, you know, a social worker come in and be supportive to a family and help the family heal, I mean, their loved one is on a path. They are on a path. They are dying, and we already know that. When you sign on to hospice, you've already crossed that bridge of will I live, will I die? When you sign on to hospice, you released all the treatments, you're done with all your treatments. The hope of living is really, you've surrendered to the fact that, you know, this is the end for you. And so, you know, to have this wonderful staff, social workers, nurses, come in now and support not just the patient, but the family, and help, you know, if there's healing that needs to go on, if there's a loved one, a son or a daughter that hasn't spoken to a parent for years, you know, the social workers would be so wonderful at facilitating healing before the patient passed away. So it was great. So I had so much respect. I knew my limitations as an owner and a boss. And so, you know, we developed this system of managers. And I think at the end, before I left my work, I think I had like between 8 and 10 managers that were so dedicated to what they did. And I had so much love and respect for them. You know, these were just the most wonderful people. And so they would take different sections of the work and, you know, and be very careful with it so that we wouldn't let anything fall through the crack. And so that was my management style, was we would meet as managers, you know, every morning and discuss any problems, how can we solve it? And I would carefully listen, and I absolutely respected the things they said. My goal was just to have wonderful deaths. You know, that's how I saw it. A good death, as sometimes we call it in hospice. I've seen poor deaths. I've seen bad deaths where people are, their pain isn't managed. They're left alone, you know, in different things. But my goal was really, how can we create a beautiful, wonderful death? And, you know, I come from a holistic background. And so, you know, we would incorporate music therapy. And I had a whole little team of massage therapists. Mm-hmm. And these are things that Medicare didn't require. But I just, as I would visualize myself laying there, and many, many times I would visualize myself, my last hours, my last days, my last weeks, what would I need? What would make this a sweet experience? And, you know, music's very important. Music can really just calm you down. So this wonderful music therapist that we had, and she's still with the company, would come in and talk to the family, and she would arrange music, and we'd put a boom box in everybody's home, and she would make special tapes, CDs for them, so that they could enjoy, you know, the music that they loved, because it does calm you down and help you. And I'm just, you know, offering a massage. You know, we cared a lot about the caregivers, which were usually the family members. We cared so much about them. They frequently, we would see a caregiver pass away, a loved one, a husband or a wife that's taking care of their terminally ill patient would get sick and die before the patient because they were so beat up. So we drew a big circle around them and tried to help them and offer a massage, offer counseling with our wonderful social workers, and on and on and on. But we tried to be holistic in the whole thing. And what, you know, besides the nurses, the doctors, the social workers, what else could we bring into their life to make this a wonderful experience? We had a little flower shop. Remember our little flower shop?
Yes.
And so we would, you know, we would bring flowers for their birthdays or different occasions, and I would always try to have little things of flowers at the door, so the nurses would be free to take a little bouquet in or a little pot of flowers. And we did that a lot. And the nurses loved to do that. They love to bring in a little pot of flowers. And when our patient passed away, we would always deliver 2 dozen roses. And that was kind of our little signature thing to let the family know that we cared and we loved them. And we did just love our patients so much. And, you know, we as a company and the nurses and the social workers and all of us, we would find ourselves going through bereavement as well. And even though, you know, you try to be professional and just kind of, you know, this is their experience, and we all know that. This is the family's experience, but it's so hard not to fall in love with your families and your patients. And, you know, we would have to comfort each other. And our music therapist used to hold a monthly bereavement class for all of us, and she would set up she had healing crystal bowls. And we would meet, and she would play her crystal bowls, and it was very healing for all of us.
I love so much of what you shared, and I just want to go back for a second. I feel like you've been on so many things. Mm-hmm. One thing, I don't remember if you told me this or if someone told me this about you, but as far as hiring, you talked about the hiring process, that you always hired the heart.
I
because
did.
Because you can change the skills later. I think you told me that.
I did. Yes. That used to be my mantra, is I would hire a heart.
Yeah, and say that again.
Yeah, I would look for, I'm highly sensitive, so when I would interview, and I was always the one that would hire, I would sit and talk for a long time. I needed to hear there was a functioning heart in that person, and I learned early on you could train anything in somebody. You could fill in the blanks of anything that they're missing, but if they don't have that, you know, beautiful heart and a desire to serve, and that used to be one of our mantras in the office, is how can I serve? How can I serve? Mm-hmm. You know, and I you know, I don't want in any way sound to be bragging, but I always felt like I would never ask anyone to do anything that I wouldn't do. So they all saw me frequently sweeping or vacuuming. Or
I remember you taking out the trash.
Yeah,
I
mean,
like,
I take out the trash.
You can take out the trash. Yes.
I mean, nothing was above me.
Yeah.
And, you know, I always tried to go and get lunch every Friday, and we'd have a delicious lunch, and that was another way to show love to the staff and appreciation. And my job, I always thought, was a cheerleader and, you know, to the staff. How can I help them so that they can do the really important work, which is help the families and the patients.
Yeah. Well, that's always stuck with me, the hiring the heart, because you can learn anything later. It's just helped me as far as my leadership mm-hmm. to try to be more loving and compassionate. And I really learned that a lot from you.
Oh,
so thank you for that. Yeah,
thank
I appreciate you.
Yeah, I also think it's important to really let people know what their responsibilities are. And so we tried really hard to share information. You know, we're only as successful as our least trained person. So, you know, we had policies and procedures in place, but we also went on in each station. You know, we really tried to make up a book for each station. I used to say to the staff, what would happen if you got hit by a bus and someone had to come into your desk and, you know, start up from where you were? And can you please have everything arranged? And this is the kind thing to do. It's, you know, so that someone else could step in and there would be no, you wouldn't skip a beat. We could just keep going. And because the work we were doing was so important. Mm-hmm. This was life and death.
Yeah.
I felt the calling of this hospice work so strongly. And, you know, I always just tried to impress that to everyone, you know, that worked for me, is this isn't just a regular job. You know, this is, you will be the last person to have contact with this person who's passing, and your kindness to this person and not missing, you know, getting, if they need durable medical equipment or if they need medication, you know, you are the one to make sure that happens. We can never go back and redo it.
Yeah.
You get a one-shot deal at this. Mm-hmm. And of course, we did make mistakes, but not many. Mm-hmm. The intensity in our office was strong, but it was only because we cared so much about our patients and our families.
It's true. And I feel, just from my experience working with you as well, and you talked about this a little, just fostering a really mm-hmm. good culture mm-hmm. in the office. And I definitely wanted to work hard for our patients, mm-hmm. but also just because I loved everyone and I didn't want to let anyone down. And so I wonder, you talked a little bit about, like, you know, bringing lunches in, and mm-hmm. maybe not everyone has the finances for something like that. Mm-hmm. So can you talk a little bit just about building team culture and what that looks like, maybe for people who don't have resources?
I think it just starts with respect. You know, it really is, you need to respect and care. And I'm going to say the word love. I loved everyone I hired. I like them and I love them.
Yeah.
And you know, I loved it when staff, you know, when everyone in the office became friends and the nurses all became friends. And I have been away from my company now for 5 years, but they still have a group Facebook and they share with each other. And a lot of these, the nurses and the social workers don't work there anymore, but they...
There's still
it makes
a sense
me
of
so
community.
Happy that they have this community.
Yeah.
One's in Australia or New Zealand mm-hmm. and kind of all over the world, you know, but they share with each other grandchildren and happy news. And I can't take responsibility for that. I just think I hired really good people. And the good people just, you know, that's just one of the things that happens when you hire really authentic, caring, loving people. Mm-hmm. You know, I always used to say there was a vibrational energy in our office. And sometimes some people would come in and they would kind of fool me on an interview, but they never stayed long.
Mm-hmm.
They always left on their own.
Yeah.
Because we held the vibrational energy in our office. We held the standard so high for our hospice. And it was so beautiful. And unbelievably, I still hear from people from time to time, and you know, some of the doctors I worked with, and they've said lovely things about how great our little hospice was.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we were not to put down the other hospices, but in the area, but you know, unfortunately, hospices were created to be a community. The way Medicare set it up was supposed to be a community situation where it would be And that's how we were. I mean, we all lived in the area. We served in the area. We weren't a big conglomerate. But unfortunately, some of the big, you know, nationwide hospices got into it, and it became, you know, dying people became a commodity. That's kind of a harsh way to say that. But, you know, they were very aggressive. And I was, where's the heart in this? You know, where's the heart in this?
Yeah.
You know, we're helping people die. This is one of the most spiritual things you can do. And, you know, so many of our nurses and staff and nurses aides, they all saw angels. And our patients saw the angels too.
Yeah, I've heard, definitely heard stories.
It was the most incredible thing.
Very amazing experiences.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, just it's such a spiritual experience, you know, that we felt so honored and blessed to be part of. And, you know, it just became this thing where we all, you know, we loved each other. We loved the work we were doing. You know, we all felt respected in the work we were doing, and it was just a very, very positive experience.
So I love what you shared about just that feeling and kind of how, and again, not to put down any other hospices, but I definitely felt the feeling in our office was we very much believed in client, you know, self-determination, whatever they chose. I remember having conversations with people on the phone and saying, you know, reach out to other hospices, get a feel for which one you feel is a good fit for you. And there was liberty to say that. It wasn't like, oh no, like make sure you tell them to come with us and that's it, you know? Oh. It was very much we cared about the patients and wanted them to have the best experience.
Absolutely.
And I loved that.
Yeah.
You know, I love that freedom to be able to be genuine and honest and respect people and their wishes.
We always felt like we got the patients that were ours. We got the patients that we felt like we could really help the best. And so there was always a calmness. It was never like close the deal, you know, and there was no quotas, and we never had a situation where we paid staff by as many, you know, for the quotas that, or the people they brought in. We just never felt that way because we weren't driven by money. You know, we had the freedom to, you know, just really go the extra mile and hire the massage therapist, hire the music therapist, and give the extra care. And I always let the nurses decide how many visits they needed to make. I would never tell them how to do their nursing, where I understand in other hospices that was a very common thing. You could only go once a week. But how could I possibly say that to a nurse who's managing this dying patient? You know, I let whatever they felt was needed. And so it felt really good to be generous that way.
Yeah.
Generous with, you know, supplies and whatever the families needed. It just, we just had a great feeling. And we had, you know, great people we worked with. Our durable medical equipment people were wonderful. They were right on the spot. The pharmacies we worked with, Kramer's Pharmacy, Andy there, you know, we love to work with local people because we all tried harder to please each other and to be successful. And it was a wonderful thing.
Yeah. And just to kind of give everyone listening a feel for just that feeling of love for one another and in the office, I just want to share an experience, if that's okay, with you and with being there. I felt like every time someone left the company and moved on to something new, it was a celebration. It wasn't this, you know, angry, why are you leaving? We really cared about people and wanted their success and happiness. And I've worked for other companies that are not that way. It's very much like, don't leave. And one experience specifically is I remember because I worked at the hospice before grad school, and I did not get into my preferred grad school. And then like that same, the week before school, they called me and had said, we have an opening. Do you want to come? And I said, I can't. I'm working for this. I felt very loyal to the hospice. And when that happened, my direct supervisor, Maren, who's awesome, she said, you have to go. You have to go. And then I think she went in and talked to you, and you came in and you gave me a big hug and you said, you have to go. And that was such an emotional experience for me. So loving in a work environment to have that kind of a thing happen. And that's always resonated with me. And I've shared that story with so many people, that feeling of love. So thank you for fostering that.
You know, I always felt we were all in a on a path, on a journey. And when someone would come to me and say, you need to move on this direction, I was nothing but happy for them, because I knew that so many people had come to the hospice early on and made it so wonderful, but then had moved on. Their life had called them to other things. So I never felt bad about them leaving. And also, you know, some would say, this doesn't work with my family life. I said, oh, your family comes first. You know, I always felt a really good feeling about just following your path. You know, and we did try to always celebrate when someone would leave, send them off in a really good way. Yeah. You know, I can't remember some of the things we did. We had kind of a ceremony and always a meal. You know, we always love to have a meal
sometimes
together.
Sometimes a cake, that definitely
happens. Yeah. Oh, yeah, a cake. And I don't know, there was lots of jewelry involved,
oh, yes,
as I remember. Yes. You know, that was always, you know, I had an account at Tiffany's. And so that was kind of a fun thing. Because nurses and social workers are the last people to take care of themselves. So every Christmas, I used to love to give them a little piece of Tiffany's, because that's the last thing they would do.
That's, you know, only Tiffany's I have is from you. I don't
oh, I
own
love
anything
that.
On my
I
own.
I love that. That makes me so happy. But, you know, it's just another way of honoring people. Like, you deserve a little blue box with a white ribbon on it. And, yeah, it was great. Yeah, I think about all the people who left, and I just, you know, we stayed in touch with them, and when people would call to say, you know, for a job, I forgot what you call it, but a referral, you know, when you give them a reference,
yeah.
Thank you. Oh my gosh, I used to just sing praises. I said, you are the luckiest person on the planet today to get this person in your company, because this is a wonderful person. And it felt good to do that. You know, it feels really good to send off people with love.
Yeah, I love that. And again, that's something that's always stuck with me too. Just recently, I had someone come up to me. I'm at my current job saying they are considering taking another job. And they expressed concern like, oh no, I feel bad. Yeah. And it's an amazing opportunity, an amazing job. And again, I feel like what you planted at the hospice helped me foster that love, and I said, you need to take it.
Oh,
go
absolutely.
For it, you know, like, you'll survive.
You only get one life.
Yeah,
you've got to follow your path. And I think I used to say that a lot. You've got to follow your path wherever that path leads you.
Yeah, absolutely. So I love so much of what you've shared, and a lot of it has been about the hospice and about you know, leadership there. I do want to ask if you, this is a little off subject, but you and Didi, your sister, would always give advice about dating and about the five, like, you can be happily. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Do you mind just sharing that? Because I think it's really good advice.
Well, I have been through divorce, subject, so, you know, that gave me a little bit of experience. I was married 20 years and then divorced. And so, you know, I have that background. I used to say, it takes a great man to replace no man. I remember saying that to people, you know, being alone isn't so horrible. And I used to quote that, you know, and it's not my quote, it's somebody else's, but I can't remember where I heard it. You know, you're happily, number one is happily married. Number two is happily single. Number three is unhappy single. But the hardest place to be is unhappy married. And I had lived that. So I used to counsel all my single friends to really be careful because, you know, it takes a great man to replace no man.
And that was definitely helpful for me as a non-married person, and I'm still not married yet, but I love that. It always made me smile thinking about that.
So. Well, and you know, when I divorced, I really put it in God's hands, and I am a very spiritual person, and my prayer was, and I've shared this with so many people, ask God to pick your husband. You know, we're really incapable of picking what will make us happy, because there's really a plan for everything. And so, you know, that was my prayer. And a man came into my life after my divorce who had four children that he was raising. And so I had five children, and we put our nine children together.
The Brady Bunch.
Yeah, we were the Brady Bunch. I used to say Brady Bunch from hell, because we didn't have that live-in lady that, you know, was on the show.
Alice.
Alice. Yeah. We didn't have Alice. But, you know, it was great, and we had our highs and our lows. But I really give my husband all thanks for our marriage because of his patience and kindness. And he's just a really wonderful man. And, you know, God brought him to me and whispered in my ear, this is the one.
Love that.
And he's not, you know, not like someone I would say is my type. So you just have to kind of get out of your own little mold of what you think life should bring you.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's great advice. Thank you so much for being on. I always like to ask one final question.
Of course.
And that is, because my podcast is called Finding Unity, uh-huh. I like to ask, what does unity mean to you?
Unity to me means loving every single person. And I'm in the habit of whispering in my head, I love you, to just about every person I meet during a day. And I work at the Timpanogos Temple. And I'm in the habit of, when patrons come by me, in my head, I whisper, I love you. And so really love is what brings us all together. In all of our imperfections, because we are so imperfect.
I love that. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And thanks for being on.
Remember that it's okay to disagree. Unity comes when we can agree to disagree while still maintaining a love for one another. For more on unity, follow us on Instagram at finding.unity or on Twitter at finding_unity.